I'm talking now to Mr. John Fiddler, who's going to tell us all about his war experiences during the 1418 war, testing. Mr. Fiddler is by profession a bell hanger. He's retired now from the strenuous side of it, and he just designs them and gives technical help to his son, who has carried on in his footsteps, and apparently they travel virtually the length and breadth of England dealing with bells. In the whole of England there are only 4 bell hangers. There's a most interesting write-up about Mr. Fiddler and his son in the Devon Life, issue March 1975.
I'm a native of Hillgrove in Cheshire, Northshire, near Stockport. And I was working in Manchester, you see. And when the war broke out, the Manchester people wanted to form a Manchester Scottish, like the Liverpool Scottish and Liverpool Scottish, you see. But anyhow, what about some of my mates and one or two Scotsmen in that I used to work with said, oh, well, join the Manchester Scottish. So there ought to be about 400 volunteered to start this Manchester Scottish. But the War Office, in their wisdom, decided against the Manchester Scottish, that the Manchester Regiment should be an ordinary regiment. So somebody gave the tip to the Royal Scots, the 9th Royal Scots in Edinburgh, you see. They sent an officer and a sergeant down and recruited the 400. They pinched 400 recruits from Manchester, you see. So the next thing was we had to go to the recruiting office in Manchester and sign the form and get the shilling, you see. And to await developments, and in a week after we got a letter to report at Albert Street Police Station, Manchester, where we'd all gather together and then go by a special train to Edinburgh, you see, which we did. It happened to be November 11th when I signed up. Anyway, the good reception in Edinburgh, of course. And there was the usual sorting things out, and our billet was in the skating rink called the Olympian in Edinburgh. You tell me what I like this fag. And the usual sorting out, marking the companies and one thing or another, you see. And I happened to be a clarinet player. I was asked to join the regimental band, which I did. And then they were wishing out with our kit, kilt and all the rest of it, and of course everybody from Manchester anyway, they said, well, what about pants from underneath the kilt, you see? So the reply was, you only wear what the army issue you with, you see, and they don't issue with pants to go under a kilt. So that's, I mean, that's that argument. And I mean, we did the usual training, man. And then we, for a spell, we moved over to Kilmarnock for some reason or other. And whilst at Kilmarnock, I lost a toe. I had a hammer toe, and then that was taken off in Glasgow. Then the battalion moved back to Edinburgh for a while, continued the usual training, and then went to Peebles on the campus. And as my foot was giving me trouble, I was given a clerk's job in the brigade office for a while. And then the battalion moved to Stirling, I believe it was, yes. And I joined them at Stirling because it more or less the foot was all right. And then this was getting 1915. And then we moved down to Essex. And we're in private billets in Essex for a while. And then, of course, things were moving in France. We're coming down now to 1916, and what would it be, June 1916, a crowd of us were sent to Aldershot, Bisley, for rifle, for firing practice. And then July, of course, the stack up in the Somme started in there, and without any warning, really, we were all slung over to France. And when we got to France, we were lost up. Our kilts were taken off us and were given trousers. And, the old setup was broken up. Some went to one regiment, some to another to make up losses. I went to the 1st Battalion, the Scottish Rifles, known as the Glasgow Sweeps. A right bloody crowd they were, too. Can you stop for a minute while I...
Yes, sure.
I got to sail along with a lot more. Got transferred to the 1st Scottish Rifles, and they were in the 33rd Division of 19th Brigade, 33rd Division. Oh, that was it. And as I tell you, that the blokes in the Scottish Rifles were compared to the 9th Royal Scots, who were students and that, and professional men. The Glasgow Sweeps were another cup of tea altogether. In fact, with one chap who was classed as a very poor barrack room soldier, but a bloody good fighter. And if any information was wanted about Jerry's lines, they used to send this bloke out, and he'd come back. I've seen him come back with a bag of Jerry mail, and invariably a prisoner. And he was a burglar by profession. And then, of course, the weather broke over, nothing but mud. And we had all kind of, well, it was the end. Seen it after, it was about, well, we forgot that we couldn't remember the dates because we were up the line, up to the waist in mud all the time, you know. And I don't know whether it was the end of October, November, when the tank, we first saw our first tank. And of course that got stuck in the mud, but the other tanks were going over. And see, we were around Albert, I'm getting mixed up with Albert because I got there later on, but there was a place called Suzanne Fleurs, Comic Coat Wood, oh blimey. Oh, and I forgot to say that when I'd moved down to Essex, I'd started training as a signaller. So one of my jobs was seeing that the line, with only a single line, and the earth was in the ground. There wasn't two lines, there was just one line and a rough telephone. Not a telephone, just a tap Morse code. There was no speaking. And it was one of my jobs to keep the line intact, and if it broke, no matter what time of the day it was, you had to follow the wire he had laid down. Of course, that was in mud and all kinds of things. And I know one night we'd relieved the French, and I had to lay a new line down and had to cross a footbridge on the Somme. And I got round my neck a bundle of telephone wire, you know. And all of a sudden Jerry opened fire, and of course I dropped down, but of course dropping on a plank was one thing, and of course I fell in the bloody river. So anyway, I was dragged out of that, and a few days after that I had toothache. Well, with the right bastard of a doctor, and he took my tooth out with a pair of pliers. Cold steel, are you? However, as a result of that, of course, my face started, of course, I got septic in the jaw, you know. And then I had to go in hospital. Well, of course, I went to the field dressing station thinking that I should, just be doctored up there. And before I knew what had happened, I got jabs in the arm and labels on. And I was sent down to the clearing station at Albert. And then from there, from Albert, the hospital train took us to Boulogne. And when I got put in a bed at Boulogne, the bloke in the next bed says, "Oh, you lucky bugger." I said, "Why?" Well, he says, "I've been here 3 weeks," he said, "and everybody that's gone in that bed's got the blighty." Anyway, he no sooner spoke than two blokes come along with a stretcher, shove me on it, and onto the hospital ship. So when we gets to Dover, two chaps came and stretchered. They said, "What part of the country are you from?" I said, "Manchester." So one of them says, "Oh, what a pity." He says, "We've just loaded the Manchester train up." Oh, I says, "That's a bit of bad luck." Anyway, he says, "You're the first for Cambridge." So of course I landed up in Cambridge. Then from there, after hospital at Cambridge, at First Eastern General, it was a wooden shanty place, the new library's on the site now, I think, at Cambridge, I'm not certain. Anyhow, after being convalescent, we finished up convalescent in Northern Ireland. And now this was beginning at 1917. And we dare not go out less than four together. You couldn't go out singly, it had to be in fours because of trouble, even then. And you might be walking down a country lane, and before you knew what had happened, you'd have brickbats thrown at you and sods. And you look around, you wouldn't see a soul, you'd have disappeared completely. That was my first experience of Ireland. And then our depot, our training depot for the 1st Scottish Rifles, was at Nigg, north of Inverness. And whilst I was there, the company sergeant made it, always a finish. He said, "What about a strike?" I said, "I don't mind, try anything once." So, having a stripe, then I was sent to a training school, NCO training school, Edinburgh Castle. We were there 8 weeks. I guess 8 weeks it was there. And I got my corporal stripes there. When I got back, there was a notice on the board. NCOs with experience in France required for service in East Africa with the King's African Rifles. So of course I thought, well, if I stop here, I'm going back to France. If I volunteer for this lot, I've got a chance of seeing the world, you see. So of course I volunteered, another chap, two of us, and we had to go down then to London, to the Tower of London, for kitting up and all that before going to East Africa. But before I come to East Africa, it was soon after I got my stripes, my corporal stripes, the company sergeant made it, he said, "Take two men as escort and pick a prisoner up in Glasgow and take handcuffs with you, because I understand he's a nasty piece of work." So I said, "All right." Went down to Glasgow, went to this police station on the south side, and the sergeant says, "My God," he says, "thank goodness you're here, take him out of the way." I says, "Why?" He says, "Nothing but trouble." He says, "Look through that window, there was a crowd outside." I says, "All right, where is he?" So I went into the cells, and it was this chap, Scott the burglar, I told him from. I said, "You silly bug, what have you been doing again?" "Oh, well," he says, you know, when I'm home, they come and fetch me, I never come home on my own." Well, I said, "All right." I said, "Now, what about this ruddy crowd outside?" "Oh," he said, "I'll soon settle them." So he went to the door, police station. He said, "It's all right, this is a buddy of mine from France." And they disappeared. So I put on cuffs on him and went to the station in Glasgow. Military police there, on guard, a reserve compartment, you know. So the train started off, the red caps locked the carriage door, saying that we should be met at Perth, where we'd be able to get a feed and the canteen there. So as soon as the train started, I took the handcuffs off Scott. "Have you got any cards?" He says, "I've got no money." I says, right, I says, I'll give you half a crown, lend you half a crown. Oh, he got his half crown back before we got to Perth. So anyway, when we got to Perth, put the handcuffs on again, you see, and the Red Caps came, and they said, you go, and we've got a feed for your prisoner, and you can go to the canteen, and we'll look after your prisoners till you... We come back. And we came back, got in the train started off again, took the handcuffs off. By the time we got to Inverness, I think we were scotted one all. he was a really card sharp, and God knows what. Anyway, at Inverness, we had to put the handcuffs on again, because in those days, nobody could go past Inverness without a passport. Beyond north of Inverness was absolutely barred to anybody without a... unless they lived there, then they had a permanent permit, you see, but you couldn't get through beyond Inverness in those days without a passport or something similar. Anyway, we got to Nig, put him in the guard room. So when the sergeant of the guard was an what we call ex-expeditionary forceman. And of course, Scott was all right with him, you see. But the new sergeant of the guard, he'd never seen active service, and he got his stripes through exams. So when the guard had taken over, I went to see the sergeant. I said, no, sergeant, I said, whatever you do, tonight after, I said, when the officer of the day has been round, I said, bring Scott out of his cell and let him sit with the guard. I said, if he wants a Jimmy Riddle, let him go, he'll come back. Of course, this young chap said, look here, he said, I know the duties of a guard sergeant. Well, I said, all right, I said, you're in charge. I said, I'm just giving you advice. Anyway, about 1 o'clock in the morning, the sergeant came to my bunk in the hut. His corporal, he said, my prisoner's gone. Well, I said, I'm not surprised. I said, I told you what to do, to bring him out of his cell and let him sit with you till morning and put him back again. He said, what shall I do? I said, go and tell Company Sergeant Major.
Can I stop you here from beyond, please?
Well, I said, go and tell the Company Sergeant Major. So the Company Sergeant Major came round to see me. He said, what the hell are we going to do? I said, damn all. I said, go back to bed. I said, wait till breakfast time. He said, what do you mean? Oh, I says, he hasn't left camp. He said, well, where is he? I says, he's somewhere in the camp. Don't you worry about that. No, I says, at breakfast time, somebody's lost the knife, fork, spoon, plate, the ruddy lot. I said, wait till breakfast time, and you can bet your hat somebody, as I say, somebody be belly aching, they've lost the tools. I says, and Scott will be sat down at one of the tables. I said, he won't give a damn which table it is, he'll go down and sit down and put it in, he'll get his breakfast. So, Company Sergeant Major, I said, are you sure? I said, yes, I know him. I said, I know what he is. So, of course, everybody went back to the duties, you see. Of course, when breakfast, we just walked in the breakfast hall. And that was Scott. I was tucking in as large as life, and he just winked to me. So I said to Company Sergeant Major, isn't there? I said, let him have his breakfast. I said, don't take him away just now. I said, you've only got to tell him, come on. So, when he had his breakfast, he just walked straight to the guard room. Of course, he was put up before a company officer for absent without leave and all the rest of it. Not desertion, just absent without leave. So, the company officer, he'd been to France, and he'd had experience with chaps of Scott's time, you see. So he just said to Scott, I suppose you want to go on the next draft. Yes, sir. And that's all. He got so many days stop in his pay, but he didn't give a damn. But he wasn't kept in the guard room. He was shoved with the men that were training for going back to France, you see. You know, that poor devil got killed on the last day of the war. Last day of, on November 10th, he got killed. Oh. What a character. And even I'm sure, I mean, I've seen him when we're in France. I've seen him when he went in for rations. It was in the dark, in, you know, in the winter time, around about Christmas. And you were A, B, C, D company, and all the different regiments, all collected at the depot for rations for the night, you know, for the following day, you see. He's got to take a party, and he'd find out which battalion was missing at the time. You haven't arrived. Right. What was it? Royal Fusiliers, with a battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in our brigade. And the number of times he picked his damn bloody rations is anybody's business. Many time with two lots of rations. God, love me, was alive. Anyway, after, as I say, I volunteered for the King's African Rifles, and we had training in Tarablon. Well, we're not training, we just kitted out. We were given more, right, talk about a kit. It was the equivalent of an officer's kit, valise, portable bath, portable wash, bed, all the ruddy lot. So we crossed over to France, and then took train across France, to Marseille. And when we got to Marseille, the ship that was to take us to Egypt had been delayed, so an extra fortnight, I think, in Marseille. And of course, a lot of chaps were going down the red lamps from the right good time. But talk about the cesspool of Europe, my God, Marseille was it. And anyway, we had 2 days in Malta, while either rationed off you or something. We're held up in Malta. We had 2 days in Malta, and then we went across to Alexander. And then we took train across Egypt to Suez, I think it was. Then a boat there waiting for us there, and it called in at Aden. Talk about laugh. Of course, at Aden, the bum boats came round selling souvenirs and fags. And they had string. They threw strings up to the deck with a basket on, you know, and you wound it, put your money in the basket, and they sent you what you wanted, fags. And it was nearly always all fags you come up. So after about half an hour, the fall in sounded. So the doctor said to the parade, he said, "I don't know how many of you have bought cigarettes," he said, "but you bought camel shit." Now, he said, "We're going to allow all these chaps to come on board with their wear. You can please yourself what you do with them." Of course, all these chaps come up with a companionway full of beans, you know, all lined up. And anyway, before they knew what had happened, they were all thrown overboard. It was just kerfuffling all your bone days. And then we landed at Mombasa after that. Travelled up the train to Nairobi, and then we were split up to different regiments belonging to King's African Rifles. I happened to be posted to the 4th, 3rd, and I was put in charge of training natives for the Maxim machine gun, for the machine gun school. I'm in Magathi Plain. I believe that's the aerodrome now where our camp was in there. And of course, we stuck there. We heard about the army. Oh, before then, there was the flu epidemic in October, and a lot of natives died, and one thing or another. And the natives said that was a sign the war was going to be finished, you see. Then we heard that the armistice had been signed, but the German East Africans were still floating about under Commander von Leto. And of course, in heavy bush country and that, of course, you couldn't. Look, you could be a few yards from the enemy and wouldn't know you were there, you see. And von Leto did give himself up till near Christmas 1918, over a month after that, as you may say, when we finished in East Africa. But we didn't get away from there till the middle of 19. And then we came back via Durban and South Africa and Cape Town, and we had to stay in Cape Town to await a troop ship coming from Australia. You see, that takes some of the Australians home. We had to wait in Cape Town. Mind you, had a damn good time in Cape Town. Really good time. And of course, they went to the races one time. And there's a horse running called Scottish Fiddler. So of course, all the lads went brunches, you see. So someone said, "Hey, Fiddler, you were in the Scottish Regiment, weren't you?" I said, "Oh, right, Scottish Fiddler we'll go for." And the bugger come in last. Oh, dear me. You know, you can just imagine...
You weren't very popular.
I can just imagine the kerfuffle. And by then, of course, with no pay, and nearly everybody got some really good souvenirs we bought in Nairobi. And I had a gold wristlet watch that I bought for the last that I was going with then. And, I don't know. So I went in a pawn shop in Cape Town, asked this chap what he'd give me for it. So he said, "Well, you know, I'll give you £10 on condition that you're not going on this troop ship that's going back." "Oh," said a couple of them, I said, "we're here for another month." I said, "The chaps that are going on that troop ship, they've already gone to the pier." "Oh," he said, "that's all right." So give me £10, and mind you, I lost it on the deal, but that was by the way. And I followed the crowd, and we're on for 10 minutes. I was on board the ship coming home. And with a rotten, the captain of the boat that the troop ship was bringing us back, he was a sod. And he'd taken on in Southampton, in Australia, contrary to his job, he'd taken on a lot of civilians to come back to England, you see. And the result was there wasn't even accommodation in the cabins for officers. They had to sleep in hammocks. And not the only place that we were allowed to move in was the after deck, just a bit of a hole. Well, I mean, you couldn't move. And the rest of the ship was out of bounds to troops until the MO put it direct straight, and the CO put it straight to this skipper, that unless he altered his attitude, there'd be serious trouble. That he couldn't confine 500 men in a small space. And then he altered his tactics then, and we were allowed to move more, and of course that we more exercise then. Of course we landed at Plymouth, and incidentally when we were at Cape Town we were issued with South African tobacco. Well, of course a lot of chaps didn't smoke it, but there was a chap there from Sheffield, a tobacconist. He collected all that, they're all in little bags, you know, and he collected any amount of this stuff and put it in the case. And when we got to Plymouth, we happened to be the first troops coming from East Africa, and there was no check on customs, and this chap was ready. He got everything prepared, the weight. He was prepared to pay duty on his tobacco, you see. Well, I should buy, I think, 200 or 300 weights of tobacco. And as I say, we'd been issued out with such big kit. Everybody had a big case, valises, the lot. And this was put on a lighter at Plymouth, and then we took to Mill Bay Dock and just dumped to shore, no customs, nothing. See. All we were called out for was the different parts of the country we lived in, you see. London and the South East, one section. Birmingham and the Midlands in another section. Manchester and the North West in another. Newcastle and Scotland in another, you see. And they made train loads of. Of course, I got in the Manchester section, and that was that. And of course, when I got back, there was no work, anything. And the only thing that, of course, I'd learned bell ringing in 1914. I'd started to learn bell ringing. And the only thing that kept us sane, really, as far as we young ringers were concerned, were playing handbells. And but for that, I reckon we should have gone, you know, bonkers like a lot of them did. All you could do was stand at street corners for no work. There was not a sausage, you know. That was the coming home fit, a country fit for heroes. But we kept ourselves sane by ringing handbells and practicing. And that handbell company's still going. And their handbells, I should think, are valued about 3,000 quid today.
What company was this?
Nobody up in Cheshire.
Yeah.
I'll show you a photograph of it later.